This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. What's your dream job? Chances are that over the years, the answer to that question has changed, probably quite a bit. Those are the questions that Dr. Kevin Hoff tried to answer in a research paper in the Journal of Career Assessment called Dream Jobs and Employment Realities: How Adolescents' Career Aspirations Compare to Labor Demands and Automation Risks. Dr. Kevin Hoff is professor of industrial organizational psychology at the University of Houston. Back in July, I asked him who they spoke to in this study.
Yeah, so we surveyed a bunch of adolescents. So there was over 3,000 adolescents from 42 U.S. states. And we have some information about their background in terms of their gender, age, and ethnicity. And what's most important for the study was we looked at their career aspiration. So just a simple question of basically what is their dream job? And then we coded those responses. So when kids report that, they report all different things, and some of them take the opportunity to make a joke about various things, but we coded all the ones that we could into standardized occupations, and then we could get information about the interests and the educational requirements and also the automation risks of these different careers.
And why did you take on this topic? What brought the interest?
Yeah, so several different things. I have always been interested in career development, and I worked in a career center as part of grad school. And one of the things that really stood out to me when I was doing that career counseling is that there's oftentimes these tricky situations where a client in this case is a student, will come in and be really interested in medical school or something else that kind of is inconsistent with the information that we can see about them, at least in terms of, like, for example, with medical school, you do need a good GPA in college. And at that career center, we can see people's GPAs as they're coming in. And so this kind of tricky situation where you want to help students ultimately achieve their goals and their dream jobs, but you also want to be realistic with them. And there's kind of a balance between encouraging them to have ambitious career goals, but also, like, being real with them in terms of what the labor market, how many of these jobs exist in the labor market, and what are the educational requirements for those jobs. And the second reason is that there really just isn't a lot of research on the labor market side in terms of the interests and educational requirements of different jobs and how many of those jobs there are.
You mentioned one thing before is the risk of automation on a job. It's interesting. Adolescents are actually thinking that far ahead, that this job won't be replaced by a robot.
So I don't think most of them are. We derived information about the automation risks from a previous study that estimated it based on a couple of different factors, which was largely due to how easy it would be for technology to do the core tasks of different occupations, and both in terms of current technology and also expected advances in the future. But that is an interesting question in terms of to what extent are you thinking about these sorts of issues in terms of their dream jobs. And I think partly our study indicates that they're not thinking a whole lot about them, at least as teenagers.
So what did you, I see you broke this up into males and females. What did you find the younger males and females were looking at? And how did that change when you looked at the older males and females?
Yeah, good question. It certainly, I think those two categories, so age was important, and then also gender. And there are fairly large gender differences in terms of the careers that youth aspire to. So for females, the most popular occupations were doctors, veterinarians, and teachers. And increasingly with age, nurses was also a very popular one. And for males, being a professional athlete was overwhelmingly the most popular career aspiration. But age was certainly important. So among 13-year-old boys, over 30% reported wanting to be a professional athlete as their career goal. But by the time they were 18, it was only down to 5%. So
reality has a way of setting in, doesn't it?
Exactly, yes. So athletes was probably the most striking example, but really the same general trend applied for most occupations, where there was, at the younger ages, there's a smaller subset of very well-known occupations that are oftentimes things that youth are exposed to either in school or on the media. So that could be on TV or the internet. Those really just dominated what kids are aspiring to. So among 13-year-olds, the top 10 occupations accounted for over 60% of all aspirations. So there's not a whole lot of variability in terms of youth career aspirations at age 13. But by the time they're 18, it was down to about 40%. So we are seeing reality sets in a number of different ways across adolescence.
So not too many 13-year-olds are saying they want to be a CPA.
No. And I think actually that CPA was, I don't think there was a single, so of these over 3,000 aspirations, there may have been one or two people who wanted to be accountants, but that the broader category of accounting, which is conventional interests, were extremely underrepresented. If youth aren't interested in those sorts of careers, that's fine, because we know that people are going to work in them anyway. But we didn't really expect there to be such a striking gap, because conventional interest jobs account for over 20% of the labor market and less than 1% of career aspirations.
I bet you those kids who did say they wanted to be an accountant have parents that are accountants.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good guess, certainly.
How do you hope this research might be used?
Yeah, so I think a couple different ways, and I think there's several different implications that have emerged from our research and from similar studies. So we do see this, really high concentration of career aspirations for a small subset of occupations, and obviously 30% of males aren't going to become professional athletes. So what I think is the biggest implication is building better career education in schools and making that more of the norm rather than the exception. And I think career education can come in a variety of different ways, but kind of the overall goal should just be to expose youth to more careers and to different careers, and to do it in a way that actually connects to their developing values and the things that they care about in terms of their peers, and so that they're not, youth aren't solely reliant on the media to gather information about what people do in different jobs, because we know that the media is not super realistic, and what people see on TV is not necessarily what people do in different jobs, and also only covers a very small subset of the different jobs that exist.
I see you talk about positive and negative outcomes for careers. Talk about what you mean by that.
Yeah, so there's different measures anyway of indicating like what's a positive or negative outcome. And with career development, I think that there's subjective and objective outcomes. And those would be subjective is people's self-reports of how satisfied they are in their job and with their choice of a career or their career progression in general. And there's also objective outcomes, which are things that we often think about in terms of like financial success or having a leadership position. And I think one thing to point out is that not everyone wants a job necessarily that makes a ton of money. Certainly that's income is one of the biggest factors that people think about, but a lot of people are very satisfied and fulfilled in careers that don't necessarily pay as much, but they fit their values in other sorts of ways. So ultimately, I think what in terms of career aspirations, there's also positive and negative outcomes of our findings, which is that generally speaking, that youth are aspiring to more prestigious careers that indicate a lot of ambition on the part of youth, but not necessarily a lot of knowledge about what's actually required to get into those occupations. So the positive outcomes would be that even if youth are aspiring to a really ambitious career, so for example, if I want to be a doctor, and as I go along in school and realize that maybe I don't necessarily love those difficult chemistry classes that I'm taking, you know, my first semester of college, that I still might end up doing something, a really important career in the medical field that just doesn't necessarily require going to 5 years of med school. So that would be a positive of having an ambitious career aspiration that doesn't necessarily work out. But the negatives are also that in some cases too, you're starting school and pursuing something and investing money in something that is not necessarily realistic, and potentially your time could be better served searching for something that is a better fit in terms of ability or interest.
And you did some work with the Occupational Information Network. What is that network?
Yeah, so the Occupational Information Network, which is often called ONET for short, is the U.S. Department of Labor's primary source of occupational data. So it's a really amazing website, and it has a ton of utility for research and then also for career exploration. But basically what it is, they have over 900 different occupation categories, and they have, for each of those occupations, they have a ton of different information about what it is that people actually do in that career, and then also the personality, interests, values, the skills that are required, the average wages, and we also use estimates about the automation risks from these coded O-net occupations.
So the bottom line for this is it's great to have a dream job, but you ought to have a backup plan too.
I think, yeah, that's certainly one of the bottom lines. And again, I think that the tricky thing is the balancing between wanting to encourage ambition, and you know, no one wants to be the teacher or counselor or parent who discourages someone from pursuing their dream job. But at the same time, I think you can also be real with them and incorporate information about the labor market and about educational requirements, and really set people up with a better understanding of what it would actually take to have that dream job.
Dr. Kevin Hoff is professor of industrial organizational psychology at the University of Houston. His research paper appeared in the Journal of Career Assessment. Still to come, lots of jobs going to automation is not really a new thing. We'll hear about teaching machines next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Today we think nothing of seeing laptops and iPads in the classroom, but there have been attempts at creating so-called teaching machines since the early 20th century. And it's the history of those teaching machines that Audrey Waters explores in her book called Teaching Machines: The History of Personalized Learning. Audrey Waters is an education technology writer and creator of the blog Hack Education. Earlier this year, I asked her why she took on the history of these machines.
I have been interested for a very long time in the history of education technology, you know, sort of how we got to this particular moment, and which seems particularly with the pandemic, right, to be very stark, the ways in which computers are used in the classroom. And I was very interested in the ways in which as well that Silicon Valley entrepreneurs tend to talk about their work as being innovative and brand new, and no one's ever thought of this or done this before. And I was interested in telling a different story, the story of the people who built teaching machines, who built these machines that were very similar, I think, to what happens today, and that have been working on them for almost 100 years.
There are so many ways I would like to start this conversation, but I'm going to go right to the pigeons. What do pigeons have to do with this story?
B.F. Skinner was, in the 20th century, probably one of the most famous public intellectuals of his time. He was a psychologist, a professor at Harvard, and he worked on pigeons, worked with pigeons in his lab. He created a theory called behaviorism, in which he argued that the way in which you could study learning, teaching and learning, was by studying behaviors. And he was particularly keen on changing the behavior of pigeons. So he would train pigeons to do things. They could play ping pong, for example. They could play the piano. And headlines like love to talk about how smart the pigeons at Harvard were. But Skinner was also interested in how we taught humans, and the same theories and the same practices that he believed applied to pigeons, he said applied to humans as well. And so when he decided to build teaching machines for humans, he was building machines that worked very similar to the way in which he trained pigeons, which is by offering them rewards for doing the right thing.
In the book, you have a photograph of Skinner's first teaching machine. What did that machine do?
So Skinner, there's a story that he would tell, and it's, I think if Skinner were alive today, it would be his TED Talk. He talked about the ways in which the typical classroom operates. One day he said he visited his daughter's fourth grade class, and he was watching the students in a math lesson. And he noticed that some students moved through the questions very quickly, and then they were bored. Some students really struggled and they weren't able to finish the lesson by the time the allotted 45 minutes were over. And then the teacher, you know, collected the work and took it home and would grade it and give it back the next day. And for Skinner, this practice of teaching really violated so many of his theories about how people best learn. He believed that people needed positive reinforcement immediately, for example. And he wanted to come up with a way in which students could move at their own pace through lessons. So he went home and he built a little box in which a student would get one question at a time, and then they would fill in the blank with their answer and then check their answer. And if they got it right, the reward would be they could move on to the next question. And so that was sort of the basis for his ideas about how we would automate this kind of practice so that people could move through lessons at their own pace.
And you start the book with Skinner's story, but really Skinner is not where this begins. You had someone way before Skinner doing this kind of work. Tell us about Sidney Pressey.
Dear Sidney Pressey, Sidney Pressey was a professor at The Ohio State University. In the 1920s, he came up with a very similar idea. He built a machine, a prototype of a machine from old typewriter parts. And Sidney Pressey used the multiple choice test. So the students would press a key to choose the right answer. He even had an additional option for his machine that if the student got the right answer, they could get a piece of candy. But Sidney Pressey ran into a lot of problems, least of which was, of course, the Great Depression, which made the demand for teaching machines, budgets for schools to be something that he just couldn't overcome. He struggled for a very long time to commercialize his machine, but to no avail.
Yeah, neither of these guys made any money on their machines, did they?
I would say that, you know, B.F. Skinner made quite a bit of money as a consultant trying to build his machine, but neither of them were successful. But there were companies that were successful. This was a very popular idea in the late 50s, early 1960s. In fact, encyclopedia sales, people would go door to door, and if you bought a set of encyclopedias, they would throw in a teaching machine as well. And it was, you know, if you think about it, it was around the time of Sputnik. Americans were very concerned about what was happening with education. It was also a time of, you know, the post-war boom. People were really interested in gadgets and this idea that there could be machines that would make American children learn better, faster, be smarter than the Russians was pretty powerful.
They're called teaching machines, but actually, when you look at the way they operate, they were just testing machines, weren't they?
In many ways, they were just testing machines. And as I was researching the book, I went on eBay and I bought myself one. I wanted to test out what it felt like, what it was like to use one of these machines. And I would say not only are they simply sort of testing machines, but the drudgery of moving through the material was something else. And I think that that's important to remember. We often talk about how excited children are when they get new gadgets in the classroom. You recall, you know, a decade ago how iPads were going to change everything and kids loved having iPads. But after a while, I think students recognize that worksheets are worksheets and that this work isn't particularly exciting, whether it's on a plastic teaching machine or on a, you know, $500 iPad. It tends to still be rather dull work.
Did you at least get a machine that gave you candy?
I did not get a machine that gave me candy, unfortunately.
Oh, no. Have teachers ever embraced these machines?
I think that some teachers did embrace them. I think that there were several pilots in which students and teachers, for a short time at least, seemed to enjoy it. Many students, for example, would say that they really liked the ability to move at their own pace through the material. And some teachers liked the idea of being able to actually just focus on the students who were struggling rather than having to talk to a whole class and then sort of, again, ascertain later how students were progressing. But I don't think that these were as popular in schools for a variety of reasons than they were as sort of a gadget that you would buy and use at home. Partially because I think then, as now, it was a huge expenditure for schools. Schools were kind of balked at the idea of making sure that every student had a device. That sounds pretty familiar.
Well, they didn't want to buy these things while they were still paying teachers, right?
Exactly.
There is one passage in the conclusion of the book. It says, teaching machines may then be one of the most important trends in the 20th century, both in education and in technology, precisely because they were not a flash in the pan, as some scholars suggested, but a harbinger. Were they a harbinger for computers?
I think they were. Often when people tell the story of teaching machines, they're sort of used as a prologue to then talk about the ways in which computers came along and then computers changed everything. But what I wanted to argue are these theories, and particularly B.F. Skinner's theories around behaviorism, really did become, excuse the pun, I guess, hard-coded into the kind of practices that were built into early computers and that remain in ed tech today. If you look at a lot of the things that students are asked to do with today's teaching machines, you'll find that they're very, very similar to the kinds of things that Skinner and even Sidney Pressey were imagining students to do almost a century ago. And the promises are still the same. You know, students will be able to move at their own pace, for example, is something that you hear a lot, that teachers will be able to understand students better because they'll have more data on what students know and don't know. So I think that rather than just being something that happened in the 50s and then went away and were replaced by computers, rather the kinds of things that teaching machines did, the kinds of educational practices and technology practices that the teaching machines offered, really became what we see in ed tech still today.
Has the past 18 months of COVID made people think, you know, we better perfect these things even more?
I think that's the sales pitch that schools are certainly getting. I think that in one way, we can look back at the last, you know, year and a bit and say, like, once again, the promises of ed tech are really overblown. This idea that you're going to be able to give a student a device and they'll be able to sort of work through things on their own or work through materials, they'll stay engaged, they'll want to participate, they'll feel motivated to sort of move on to the next lesson, for example. I think we know that that's simply not true. I think that students miss teachers miss students, but they also miss one another. And I think that that's another part of the teaching machines. These are very isolating devices. It's you and your teaching machine. It's you and your iPad, you and your computer working through a list of questions. That's very different than being in the kind of social space of a classroom. I mean, I think that there are ways in which tech entrepreneurs want to make things flashier. They'll change the graphics a little. They'll add new bells and whistles. But really that community, that communal social aspect isn't something that they can engineer into a teaching machine, even with Zoom, even with the internet. I think that these devices are very individualized. And of course, that's part of their promise. Personalized learning is about the individual.
But so much of what students learn in school has to do with learning how to socially interact, and a machine can never do that, can it?
A machine, I don't think, will ever be able to do that, no.
Audrey Waters is an education technology writer and creator of the blog Hack Education. Her book is called Teaching Machines: The History of Personalized Learning. Today, we can look farther and deeper into the universe than ever before. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
A new telescope could tell us a lot more about the origins of our universe. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Chris Impey, University Distinguished Professor in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona, looks into the lens for more.
I'm excited that we might soon be able to learn more about the dark ages of the universe. Astronomers have accumulated a lot of evidence that our universe began with an event 14 billion years ago called the Big Bang. From this initial ultra-hot, ultra-dense origin, the universe has expanded to reach the vast and cold state we see today. The early universe was a glowing fireball, a high-energy particle soup with no structure. As it faded to black, the universe entered a long dark ages. but it was not perfectly smooth, and tiny ripples in density were the seeds for the subsequent formation of stars and galaxies. Astronomers call this first light. We don't know how long the Dark Ages lasted, but it was probably several hundred million years. Enter the James Webb Space Telescope. This successor to the Hubble Space Telescope is due for launch in December, and it was perfectly designed to nail down the end of the Dark Ages. James Webb is many years behind schedule, billions of dollars over budget, and an extremely complicated piece of hardware, so astronomers await its launch with nervous anticipation. It will collect 7 times more light than the Hubble Space Telescope, and its detectors are optimized to detect infrared light, the wavelength range of distant galaxy light after it has been stretched by the expansion of space. Pinning down the end of the Dark Ages will let astronomers answer several important questions in cosmology. Which formed first, stars or galaxies? Was there an early generation of black holes, and did galaxies nucleate around them? And what was the role of dark matter, a ubiquitous but still enigmatic ingredient of the universe, in the timing of the end of the Dark Ages?
That was Chris Impey of the University of Arizona. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for a look at some of the coolest people we've met this year. That's on the next edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.